Hello again and welcome to In the Studio. Redbeard here with the stories behind history's greatest rock and roll songs.
You're welcome. Guitar up.
Today, in the studio, it's part two of the ultimate 4-CD, 70-song heavy metal box.
It's the energy, you know? It resonates within a lot of people, heavy metal or heavy aggressive music. People hear it and can instantly relate because it strikes a chord within them that they can, you know, just relate to. It takes them away in a way they want to be taken away.
Here I am. You like a hurricane.
When we grew up in a post-war Germany, you know, so it was not like when you're in America, people, you are proud of your country. When we grew up, we were not really proud of our country because of history. We were not proud of our country, and our parents were not proud of our country. They just survived the war. And starting as young musicians playing English and American music, it was in a way something like an attempt to be part of the world community, to escape where you feel this burden, to feel this burden
yes.
of your history, and to be like, to become a world citizen. Hi, this is Klaus Meiner of the Scorpions. Welcome back in the studio.
Hi, this is Ozzy Osbourne. In the studio with Redbeard.
I'm David Coverdale of Whitesnake talking to Redbeard.
Hey friends, this is James from Metallica.
Yo, this is Kirk of Metallica.
And you're in the studio.
Hi, I'm Jeff Tate with Queensryche.
This is Chris DeGarmo, and we're back in the studio.
No discourse on heavy metal music can be attempted without paying tribute to the original Black Sabbath. Of the 70 songs and more than 60 bands featured on the Rhino Ultimate Heavy Metal Box, only the original Black Sabbath with Ozzy Osbourne have been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Even though the Ozzy era songs aren't included on this collection for contractual reasons, it's vital to realize that the world was a very different place when Black Sabbath released their debut album in February 1970. By then, President John Kennedy, his brother Senator Robert Kennedy, and civil rights humanitarian Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had all been assassinated. The Vietnam War, which had already dragged on for 6 years, escalated in 1970 to an even bloodier level, with television nightly news showing images of fiery napalm bombs burning Vietnamese civilians, with endless body bags returning to America containing dead American soldiers no older than the members of Black Sabbath themselves, and thousands of Soviet and U.S. nuclear missiles deployed around them in England and Europe, it's easy to see that the lyrical themes of war, monstrous evil, paranoia, and encroaching technology to create even more efficient ways to annihilate the world were Black Sabbath themes that now, almost two decades after the end of the Cold War, may appear cartoonish. But believe me, in 1970, these were simply manifestations of daily life. We had the Vietnam War. We had the draft then. We had Richard Nixon in the White House. We had the bomb. And we had Black Sabbath. All four members came from Aston, a tough neighborhood in the northern industrial English city of Birmingham. Guitarist Tony Iommi, bass player and lyricist Terry Butler, nicknamed Geezer, drummer Bill Ward, and John Ozzy Osbourne. Here's how Ozzy remembers that magical moment of getting to hear the test pressing of the first Black Sabbath album, which they had just recorded.
I took the album home, and my folks got one of these old great big radiograms. I says, "Mum, I made a record." I was just so happy that I'd made a record, you know. So I hadn't heard all the bells and all this stuff that had been added on. So I put the record on, and it starts with this thunder and the bells and the rain. Thinking I've given me the wrong record, you know. And then the music starts and my folks are ready to do a knees up boo beers drinking song, you know. And my father turned around to me and says, "Son, I'm going to ask you a question and you've got to be honest to me." I says, "Yeah." He says, "Are you sure you're just drinking alcohol?" I says, "Yeah. Why? What's the matter?" He said, "This is very odd music. This is not music. This is weird."
Oh no, here it comes again. Can't remember.
originally on the 1980 Black Sabbath album Heaven and Hell, featuring lead vocals by Ronnie James Dio, that's Neon Nights, included on the Heavy Metal Box. Black Sabbath's and Deep Purple's huge success in the first half of the 70s decade extended out from England in all directions, finding just as many eager fans to the east as here in America, according to Klaus Meine and first Rudolf Schenker of Hanover, Germany.
We were thinking, especially when we started with Scorpions, we was born in the wrong place, because we had much more feel to the English-American kind of music than the German bands did.
When we grew up, we grew up in a post-war Germany, you know. So it was not like when you're in America, people, you are proud of your country. When we grew up, we were not really proud of our country because of history.
That's interesting point.
We were growing up, we were kids like, were brought up after the war. You know, in Germany, that was just rebuilding, you know, it was like on an upswing kind of situation with a very positive vibe. But still, it was not something, because when we as kids, we learned about the history, you know, we were not proud of our country and our parents were not proud of our country. They just survived the war. You know, so that's the way we got up. And starting as young musicians playing English and American music, it was in a way something like an attempt to be part of the world community, to escape, you know, a place where you feel this burden, to feel this burden [S2] Yes. [S1] of your history, you know. And this way we became free musicians and we joined a world of free musicians, a world of free people, you know? And I think that was a big motivation, even though in those days we were definitely not thinking about that. Of course not, you know? We were thinking about getting girls, you know, playing cool songs, you know? And
sure,
like everybody, right? But yeah. I think looking back in those days, it was definitely a way to become a musician and to be like, to become a world citizen.
You like felt. His mind was shaking really loud. Get his furry, scratch my skin. So what is wrong with another sin?
The Scorpions from 1984's Love at First Sting, now a part of the Heavy Metal Box. I'm Redbeard. Coming up, James Hetfield and Kirk Hammett of Metallica, Jeff Tate and Chris DeGarmo from Queensryche, and next, David Coverdale of Whitesnake in the studio for the Heavy Metal Box Part 2.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I sound like a weatherman. Helena got 6 inches last night. Hey, if it ain't stiff, it ain't worth a f***, right? Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm David Coverdale of Whitesnake talking to Redbeard.
Thank you, David. The Whitesnake 87 album is one of the top-selling albums of the entire 1980s, yet it's a miracle that it ever came out. Because of 2 work stoppages during recording, all of the musicians left. Here's David Coverdale.
The initial thing that ground to a halt, I must confess, was I developed an appalling sinus infection, which prevented me from singing not only in tune, but without any range at all. Now, I'd started the sessions at the end of 85, and I was singing guide vocals, vibing the band as we cut in the tracks, and singing like a bitch, you know, it was really happening. And then we stopped for guitar overdubs and stuff, and I did my best to ruin my health in Vancouver. You know, it was quite a party town in those days. But I started to sound very nasal, like I had a cold, but I didn't. I didn't have the symptoms of a cold, but I sounded like it. And the first song I went in for was Is This Love? I thought, I won't overdo it, you know, let's see. And I sang the song from beginning to end, out of tune. And I couldn't tell. And at the end of it, I was dripping with sweat. I was exhausted. And that is not really an exhausting song to perform. So I went to see a couple of specialists in Vancouver, and they said, you know, oh, you've got a cold, blah, blah, blah. And it was just terribly frustrating. I called my manager, Howard Kaufman, and John Kolodner at Geffen, and said, look, they've recommended I have a couple of weeks, you know, get some sun on my chest, dry my sinuses, et cetera, et cetera. So we pulled the plug and went back, and I was getting more and more nasal. So my manager sent me to Dr. Edward Cantor, who I strongly believe to this day saved my career, and he turned into a very good friend, etc. And within seconds, he put a small flashlight into my mouth, put the lights off in the his surgery, put the flashlight on, and he went, oh my God, this is the worst sinus infection I've ever seen. And he said, no, I'm surprised you can even talk. So the initial, I said, well, look, I'm behind on a project, etc. I said, is there an inter? He said, sir, he recommended surgery, which of course frightened me to death. What had happened? I was born with a deviated septum, and it decided to collapse on me. And it was not drug related in any way, although I'm sure certain aspects of the 70s didn't help. But that was his major recommendation. But because I was in the middle of a project and behind, he put me on a course of an antibiotic called Keflex for 6 weeks. And it actually, and I didn't drink for, you know, that was the first time, you know, I came to terms with sobriety, which I thought was pretty happening, you know. I was looking good in the skin, etc. So 6 weeks later, I get the clean bill of health. Sykes, Stone, and I fly down to the Bahamas. So, you know, and within the week of him giving me a clear bill of health, a week to the day that I started to sing, the infection had flooded back in. Just completely the same as it was prior to the course of antibiotics. And I came back and prepared for surgery, and the 50-50 chance I'd never be able to perform again. But I must tell you, the only thing I can compare it with is castration. The idea of not being able to do it ever again would really compromise the joy of living. I tried as a thinking person to come to terms with the idea that I could still write, I could still produce and express myself through that, but of course somebody else would be singing my songs, you know? It was a dreadful, dreadful, dreadful 86.
So David Coverdale had the sinus surgery that could possibly save his singing voice or seal his fate forever. Which would it be? After recuperating, there was only one way to find out. I asked Coverdale how he felt the first time in the studio, stepping up to the microphone to sing after surgery.
Well, I've got to tell you, extremely nervous. Indescribably nervous. I mean, I don't think there's a word for it. Olsen was great. He said, let's just have a couple of run-throughs. I said, what do you want to start with? He said, Still of the Night, which I almost vomited. You know, you can't be serious. He says, I won't record it or whatever. And I sang the song twice. And just fingers crossed, and that's what's on the record. It's a blend of two passes. And then he went, I think we've got that one. And because I thought I was just doing run through, so there wasn't the psychological weight that I was going for it.
Sweet, and I just wanna make love to you, feel your body heat.
Now included on the 4-CD Heavy Metal box, that's Whitesnake with Still of the Night. Heavy metal was simply a starting point for Seattle band Queensryche in 1983, who have gone on to bridge the musical gap between heavy metal and progressive rock with albums such as Operation Mindcrime in 1988 and mass hits just a few years later with Empire. So it was highly ironic that this band's lead singer Jeff Tate and former lead guitarist Chris DeGarmo, two of the brightest, most articulate, and sincere musicians in the business, should just happen to provide us with a heavy metal Spinal Tap moment here in the studio recently. Chris DeGarmo starts us off, then Jeff Tate of Queensryche.
If you're being honest, you need to look at decisions and accept mistakes and accept the possibility of mistakes. Mm-hmm. And then to find an answer or a solution, you've got to be able to accept the fact that, well, okay, whatever you're doing, whether you're trying to get a job, you know, you're trying to build a bike, you know, whatever it is you're trying to do, I mean, introduce me to somebody who's never made a mistake and I'll, you know, call you a liar. It's a good thing to recheck your information. You know, we need to just, with everything, you just need to always keep an update of fresh ideas and re-look at things, because the landscape changes and requires new thinking.
You know, it's also, it requires a lot of work, it's a lot of responsibility. And we get, like you said earlier, we get very lazy, you know, we want to turn on the news and we just expect through tradition, through what we've been taught, that is going to be accurate reporting. And anybody that's in the industry knows, of course, that, you know, with budget constraints and, the amount of money they have to pay people to do investigative journalism, that honestly, it ain't getting done. You know, it's somebody Yes. writing a byline and passing it down the wire. Wow. And it gets printed in all the newspapers and the radio stations run with it. And a perfect example, just recently, this is kind of bizarre, but we had I had a solo project out a few years ago, and the guitar player that played in my band, the day the tour ended, last time I ever saw him, he walked off the tour bus, never saw him again. But he has resurfaced recently, and yesterday I did a news interview. He has been convicted of identity theft, and he's been stealing people's information out of the mailboxes or whatever, and then running credit card scams and all this. And he's been telling everybody he's the guitarist in Queensryche.
Oh, no.
And so the news ran the guitarist in Queensryche's photo on the news, and guess whose picture it was? Yours.
What?
Yeah.
You're telling me this morning?
Yeah.
Right now on the radio?
It was just yesterday.
Some guy, they're
just
running
yesterday.
My picture.
Yeah. So, you know, Chris DeGarmo is now, his picture is out all over the place as this other person because—
Wanted somebody, for ID theft?
Wanted for identity theft. So— That is just a small example.
Wow. That is just, I mean, perfect.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. Redbeard.
It's not weird. It is irresponsible. That's just terrible. I mean, well, it's not funny, is it, Chris? I mean, it's not funny. It's terrible.
My vibe's blown, Redbeard.
Yeah, he wants to quit the interview. We were
about ready to bail.
We were in a good groove.
Good choice, Jeff.
Sorry, just popped into my head. It seemed timely, you know.
It is timely, but it's
well,
just
the funny thing
a
was,
drag.
Or the tragic thing was, is that he told the police that he was the guitarist in Queensryche. And
well, I could see that happening,
him.
But
I mean,
the thing about putting
of identity theft, and he says he's this other guy.
So what, you're telling me he's occupied my identity for the purposes of his conviction?
Apparently.
Man, that's
great.
I know what Chris is going to be doing as soon as we get done with this interview.
That's getting back to the point. That is a small example. Of
it's
what
not very
I'm
small.
Sure happens.
Gee.
Yeah, Jeff. Well. real friggin' small there. Yeah, let's run your photo around. Yeah. You know,
Chris, that's terrible. We're all laughing at it, but that's awful.
Well, because it's so extremely bizarre.
It is.
Constantly. Well, this is an exciting interview. This is off to a. Very brisk pace right now.
He's not going to be able to focus.
I need any coffee right now. I'm fairly pissed at the moment.
He's not going to be able to focus on anything I say for the rest of the morning. Oh, that's terrible. Okay, well, I'll try to pull this back together. Man, that's awful.
What's our engineers over here Googling on the internet, trying to pull up my wanted picture already?
Right. DeGarmo, America's most wanted.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's going to be a mess for a while. That's going to be a mess for a while. That you're right. That I mean, oh, geez. Okay.
I'm sorry. I just have to. I hate to do this live. Okay. What organization decided to run a photo of me for this idiot?
Where it was a news.
Somewhat local news affiliate or something, huh?
Yeah.
Huh.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, I hate to break it to you. That's awful.
Okay, well,
can you get it back together?
I'm trying to. Hey, so where were we?
Queen of the Reich, embryonic heavy metal from 1983, and the Seattle band Queensryche, who went on to so much more and continues to amaze with a new release and tour even now. Up next, the undisputed current heavyweight champions of heavy metal, James Hetfield and Kirk Hammett of Metallica. Join me, Redbeard, for the conclusion of part two, The Heavy Metal Box.
Hey friends, this is James from Metallica.
Yo, this is Kirk of Metallica.
And you're in the studio.
Thank you guys, bringing us completely full circle. Metallica is in a direct family tree of hard rock, heavy metal, musical evolution that you can trace from 1969-1970, beginning with Deep Purple's third album, In Rock, or Steppenwolf, and Black Sabbath. Then the first Montrose album in 73, Judas Priest in the mid-70s, Iron Maiden and AC/DC in the late 70s to the early 1980s, all of whom we've chronicled here in the last 2 weeks in the studio. Like AC/DC's Back in Black a decade before it, Metallica's Black Album is the hard rock collection for people who don't even like hard rock. Metallica, lead guitarist Kirk Hammett and rhythm guitarist singer James Hetfield point to getting the opening slot on Ozzy Osbourne's 1986 tour for being Metallica's baptism by fire. James Hetfield follows Kirk Hammett.
Professionalism on a completely different level, you know? It was also really, really great to be out on a supporting arena tour.
Why?
Because we were young, you know, we had something to prove, and we had accessibility to the audience, you know, that we wanted to reach, and it was more attitude of just going out there and just conquering as many people as we could with our shows, a really go for the throat type of attitude, and we just went out there and just played our butts off, and. It was also great opening up for Ozzy because he was such a huge inspiration, you know, him coming from Sabbath. And yeah. Cliff was in heaven the entire time. Cliff would just constantly talk about how great it was and how great of a time he was having.
Yeah, Ozzy was, he was a hero for us all, really.
Yeah, definitely.
And just to see how other outfits ran on the road and, wow, Ozzy's got a personal guy, and, you know, ooh, you know.
Yeah.
And, well, you can't drink in the hallways because Ozzy, you know, this and that. It's like, whoa. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the other side of it all. You know, you can go too far with some of this. But truly, there were a lot of fans out there that had never been exposed to something a little heavier or a little more hardcore than, you know, your Sabbath or Ozzy. And we gained quite a few fans on that. And I learned a lot of, I guess, a little more performance, you know. There was... You know, we'd just go out, bang our heads, and play as fast as possible. But then I learned, well, you know, you got to talk between these songs. You have to, you know, there's a performance part to this, you know. And it really, you know, I would not look great in a long, sparkly coat like Ozzy. But, you know, there was some showmanship to it all. And that, you know, the more you practice something, the more you're on the road, the better you get at it. And we definitely became the road dogs at that point. The other thing was power. I think that all the power that you had really had on stage and the control, because in it was Long Beach Arena where the fans started to rip up all the seats.
Yeah,
remember that?
Yeah,
they just started tearing the seats up and throwing them, and you know, they a lot of our fans would come to these arenas and think they're still in a club and can trash the place. You know, so they're tearing stuff up, and you know, they're ruining this arena. And at that point, it was like, wow, I need to step up to the plate here and, you know, tell them what's going down here. It's like, stop. This is, you know, it was kind of the first time I had to tell the crowd to stop doing something. You know, it was always, come on, do something. And now it was, whoa, this has gone a little too far. And, you know, we have to pay for these seats. That was the main bit.
Thank you. can't tell if this is true or dream. Deep down inside, I feel the scream. This terrible silence stops in there. Now that the war is through with me, I'm waking up, I cannot see that there's not much left of me. Nothing is real but pain now. Hold my breath as I wish for death. Oh, please, God, wake me. Back in the womb, it's much too real. In pumps life that I must feel, but can't look forward to reveal. Look to the time when I live, head to the tomb that sticks in me. Just like a wartime novelty, tied to machines that make me be. Cut this life off from me. Hold my breath as I wish for death. Oh, please, God, wake me.
Metallica, with One, originally on their album And Justice for All, now a part of the heavy metal box. Since then, Metallica has gone on to sell, are you ready for this? 57 million albums in the U.S. alone. Now that's proof that heavy metal is more popular now than ever before. Yet the traditional gatekeepers of rock success, that is, radio, Rolling Stone magazine, and the Grammy Awards, they all thought that by ignoring heavy metal since its inception, it would simply go away and die. That conspiracy lasted a full 20 years. Again, here's James Hetfield and Kirk Hammett of Metallica.
Conspiracy like that.
Yeah, really, because that's pretty spot on. It's the energy, you know, I think. It resonates within a lot of people, heavy metal or heavy aggressive music. People hear it and can instantly relate because it strikes a chord within them that they can, you know, just relate to. It's the energy, it's the aggression, and a lot of people have, you know, points in their lives where hearing energy and aggression in music really, really makes them feel better and makes them forget about all the daily crap that they have to deal with. It takes them away in a way they want to be taken away.
That's Kirk Hammett of Metallica. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this.